So Felidae?
I think that's how I was. They were saying it.
Felidae. I think so.
Felidae. Felidae.
There's a theme song. Yeah, we have a song in this case to tell us how to pronounce the title.
Oh my God, the song.
Boy George. The Boy song. George.
Full we're going to use the Boy George pronunciation. I was walking around for like a half hour singing this song to myself.
This song?
It's an earworm. Felidae.
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 This song does not stick in my head.
Oh man, it's in my head.
I don't know that folk music suits Boy George. I'm not totally sure.
Felidae.
You know what also is a banger? I don't feel no pain no more.
Is that a Boy George?
No, that's the Plague Dog song.
Oh, yeah.
And it turns into like a gospel song if you stick around in the credits. Yeah. Before that, it's like this a cappella thing. And then all of a sudden, they're like, we're going to the other side.
Like, to the island.
Swimming out to the Isle of Dogs.
There is no island. Well, we'll get to that. Boy.
Yeah, oh, we'll get to that.
Well, should we, you're going to intro?
All right. So the way we start these is we got to sync up our audio for later. So I'm going to just count us off like a rock band. I'm going to go 1, 2, 3, 4, and then we're all going to clap.
Oh, you know what I thought, Tony, since I heard them do that on the Conan's podcast? I think it's more intuitive if you count down. So we're like 3, 2, 1, clap.
You want to do 3? We can do 3.
I feel like we've done that. We've done it so many different ways, and it's always been mixed results.
Yeah.
Well, we're gonna have one less beat now to get the tempo, so everybody better pay fucking attention.
This is Conan.
3, 2, 1, clap. That'll be the thing.
Yeah.
So let's give it a try. 3, 2, 1.
Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, the podcast home for wayward films where we decide if they're fit to be released into society. I am Mark D'Ottavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we're discussing two films that prove neither animation nor talking animals are just for children or even squeamish adults. Those films are Martin Rosen's 1982 adaptation of Richard Adams' The Plague Dogs and Michael Schacht's 1994 grisly feline murder mystery, Felidae.
Meow.
Meow.
Bark, bark.
All right, Seth, you want to introduce our very special guest for this episode?
Yeah, this is Aaron Reese we have in the house here. In my opinion, at least, a little bit of a animation fanatic and little know-it-all. I feel like you every time I'm like posting anything about animation online, Aaron's got like a bunch of facts about it that I didn't know, and I always appreciate it. I know you go to like conventions and you meet a lot of creators and voice actors and things like that, and I can see in the background, if you're watching the YouTube link, that there is like quite a collection. You're quite a collector.
Quite a lot of junk.
So I knew on our first animation episode, we should get Aaron. Welcome, Aaron. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. I mean, I did teach an after-school program on animation for about 6 years. I did a thesis on animation in front of a board of historians. One of the people of which was the son of an animator from Snow White. His dad was an in-betweener for Dobby.
Wow.
So I've been into animation history a long time, and I've known Seth a long time too.
Yeah, high school.
Yeah, when I told my parents I was doing this episode with you guys, my mom had to say, "Oh, I had little Seth Troyer in third grade."
And I'm still little. Say hi to your mom for me. And I don't mean that in some sort of silly joke way. Your mom was a good third grade teacher, I gotta say.
Oh, well, I will let her know you said that.
Yes. Yeah, happy to have you on the podcast to talk about the weird outliers of animated history, I think it's safe to say. Both of these movies I'm very interested in having on the podcast. And they aren't necessarily the obvious choices for like unwatchables, but to me they're like very they're an interesting gray area where there is like there are the Fritz the Cats. There's like today there's Adult Swim where it's just like X-rated, wild, off the chain, any like tits and ass and death and feces everywhere.
Man, your third grade teacher is shaking her head right now.
I know. I'm sorry, Mrs. Reese.
Let's just remember this is a podcast primarily for children.
Yes. And speaking of children, the other side of animation seems to always be Disney G-rated films. And there was a time, it seems, and there's still, you know, are every once in a while outliers, but it seems like during this like sort of 80s, Ralph Bakshi was part of it as well, that there was like this rise in, or attempted rise in these films that are sort of like PG-13, like intense themes, more adult content, but not necessarily like just doing it for the sake of being like gross, like an R. Crumb thing. And again, like definitely like both of these movies are not for kids at all. It is like just there's serious attempts at just animated features. And they just don't fit in those boxes, really, that we're used to seeing with animation. And first off is The Play Dogs.
Yeah, and I think that I'm really glad that we have Aaron on here and somebody who is kind of specializes in animation, because I've seen plenty of animated films, but I'm not sure I totally have the vocabulary to talk about them. And for these ones especially, like Seth said, nowadays, at least in the mainstream, if you're going to the theater to see an animated film, it's going to be a family film. And any movie buff is going to be familiar with animated films that, you know, are not solely in the realm of children's entertainment. But these particular ones do all feature talking animals, and that's definitely a staple of children's fiction. So on one hand, we have the animation aspect, and on the other hand, we have these kind of anthropomorphized animals that is something that you often don't see an adult story being told through. And, you know, these movies are not, you know, jokey about that at all. So it was definitely interested to go into these. And I think it goes into unwatchable territory because, you know, these do deal with some very adult themes, and there's some really brutal things that happen in these movies. And in that sense, thank God they're animated.
Oh my God.
For sure.
Plague Dogs non-animated version, no thank you.
That's something I don't want to see.
I already have enough questions when I watch like The Incredible Journey and things like that, where I'm like, how many animals died during this?
Yeah, if you are if you're a person that goes to before you see a movie and you go to the website Does the Dog Die, these movies are not for you. I can just tell you just straight out, just save your time. But if you're someone who appreciates serious animation, and I'm not talking, like as Seth said, not gross out Ralph Bakshi draws a dick and it's funny because, oh my God, it's a penis in a, you know, an animation, it's a cartoon. It's not like that at all. If you're into something serious and it's an animated picture, then check this out. I think before we start, we should probably establish that this is the follow-up to Watership Down. I feel like that's a movie a lot of people are familiar with, is Watership Down.
Yeah, we were definitely wanting to touch on that.
Yeah, I just watched that for the first time for this episode so that I could be familiar with it.
Yeah, I read that. I might have been in your mom's class, Aaron, the book Watership Down, and it is it's intense. It is like a 400-page book about rabbits and an intense fantasy lore. There's like all these languages that the rabbits have. This is sort of Richard Adams' thing, is like this weird in-between zone where it's like, it's not a cute little story about rabbits. It's not like a adult fantasy story. It's still about rabbits. It's, again, falls into this like strange in-between zone, but is very much, it very much introduces something that comes into play in Plague's Dogs in a much bigger way, is this immense respect and reverence for nature, I think, with these like stories of an epic quest that is led by a rabbit who can see visions named Fiver, and they have to like, they're escaping the danger, the great danger and stuff like that. But there's the movie adaptation, which is it Mark Rosen is the director of Watership Down?
Martin Rosen.
It establishes a very like no holds barred. Like 1 minute there's a cutesy scene happening, and the next minute there is a battle between various rabbits, and there is blood, and they scratch each other's eyes and rip their ears and things like that. There's talk of mating. There's all sorts of bodily functions happening and things.
And just to be clear, so Richard Adams wrote Watership Down and The Plague Dogs, and both of the films were made into movies by Martin Rosen, who actually, those are his only two directing credits as far as feature-length films. I believe he was more of a producer, kind of a theater director guy, and he just got into the Richard Adams adaptation business, which actually kind of made me think about how, for a while, Frank Darabont, the director, made The Shawshank Redemption, finally made another movie, which was The Green Mile. And for a long time, he was like, oh, this is just the guy who adapts Stephen King prison movies. And he actually, he did then do The Mist, which took him out of the prison setting, but was still a Stephen King adaptation. So basically, he, you know, Martin Rosen is linked with Richard Adams. And it started with Watership Down. The film came out in 1978, but the book was written in 1972. And I do want to talk a little bit about Richard Adams, the author, because he's known for this way that he anthropomorphizes animals, but in kind of a more naturalistic and thoughtful way. It's not at all a cute or cartoony kind of thing. The animals, even though they are able to speak English, they do evoke how actual animals might think or act. And a lot of his books I wasn't aware of are follow through on that. He has another book called Shardik that's about a giant bear. There's one called The Ship's Cat about this Elizabethan ship's cat. That's a narrative poem for children. There's another one called Traveler, which is basically looking at the Civil War through the point of view of Robert E. Lee's favorite horse. So like, this is definitely his thing. And he was at one point even president of the RSPCA, the Royal Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. So, you know, in that sense, he is kind of an environmentalist and an advocate for animals and against fur. But his books don't read to me, and I've only read The Plague Dogs, as like tracts or environmentalist, you know, lectures or anything. They're very complex. There's allegory in them, and they have really like suspenseful, riveting, surface level adventures that are going on. But beyond that, in his writing, there's so much dark humor and irony. And like Seth was saying, like mythology, as far as Watership Down goes, he likes to play with language and different dialects.
Yeah, I would compare it to, I haven't read his books. I've only seen the two movies, but what I would compare that to is something like Redwall, possibly, where it's not quite totally for kids, but not quite adult either. There's still a lot of complexity there. Possibly even Kenneth Graham, too. There's a bit of a Wind of the Willows kind of feel, a little bit. The way, like, the different, there's different animals and the way they just interact with each other, the way different types of humans do. That's an idea that's, like, definitely explored in both. Both of these stories.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of thing that I think gets forgotten about, like fantasy involving anthropomorphic animals. Again, I would compare him to Tolkien in the way that it seems like these things start out as like little children's stories or something, where they're like, oh, there's a rabbit and he's on an adventure, and then like the kid goes to sleep and the guy is left there and he's still just like, and now I'm gonna pen the history and the mythology and the glossary, and the kids are like, what are you talking about, Dad? And then I'm going to have the dogs go on this horrifying adventure, and it's going to have all kinds of economic and environmental like underpinnings and things like that. So yeah, I guess we should dive into the tank full of poison gas and water that is Plague Dogs.
Yeah, and I'll do just a quick little summary here. And I think that a big difference between Plague Dogs and Watership Down, at least from what I can tell, and this maybe is a little more pronounced in the book than in the film, is that Watership Down is all animal characters. So it's basically an allegory, from what I understand, that mainly is just about the animals interacting with themselves, where the Plague Dogs is very much about a human's relationship with animals and our power and responsibility towards them. And again, the human characters are much more significant in the book, but we'll talk about how that's handled specifically in this movie. But it does start out in this animal testing facility. It's basically where they run these cruel experiments on animals that, at least in the foreword to the book, Richard Adams says are all based on actual experiments that had been done on animals, although there was probably wasn't one place that did all of them on all different kinds of animals like this. But he did take inspiration from real life.
The facility is referred to as ARSE, A-R-S-E or something.
Yep. That's a little bit of his humor there.
Clever.
Yeah.
Very clever. But of course I laugh, but the opening shot is, if I'm not mistaken, a dog being drowned because of a experiment, basically, like struggling underwater as like scientists watch.
Yeah, it's basically to see how long he can last, and they do it over and over again to see if he can last longer each time. So I think the opening scene of this movie really prepares you for the pretty grim tone going in, because it's very evocative. You get these opening credits that are over these sounds of struggling and drowning, and we see that that's one of our two main characters, Ralph, who's a Labrador mix, who's, you know, being tortured in this experiment. And just to give a real, just, we can go scene by scene here, but just so everyone gets an idea of exactly what the, you know, surface level plot summary is here. Ralph and another dog, a fox terrier named Snitter, are in this animal testing facility. They're able to escape one night, and most of the movie is them traversing the countryside with hunters trying to catch them, and eventually a journalist starts a rumor that they might be carrying the bubonic plague, because that has been studied in the laboratory where they escape from. And that leads to all kinds of irony, where it actually ends up protecting the dogs to some extent, and the dogs think that, you know, maybe Snitter has powers that are keeping the people from harming them, but really they're just afraid because they think they might have plague. But on the other hand, that ends up, you know, they end up getting the government officials involved, you know, military is called in to hunt them down, and it's basically them trying to escape and survive without, you know, having any owners or purpose and trying to live as wild animals. But yeah, just to go back to the beginning, I think this opening sequence with them escaping and going through this lab of horrors where we see rabbits and rats all in these contraptions, and this horrible image of this monkey in an isolation chamber that it returns throughout the film.
This is the reason years and years ago, I started watching this movie, and this opening was the reason I stopped. I had to come back to it later, because this movie, right out the bat, it doesn't make the mistake Watership Down did before it, where Watership Down opens in this very surreal type of fantasy sequence. And it kind of looks like it could be a children's movie. This movie makes the correction, saying, like, this is what you're going to get. Like, this is what the movie is. Animal torture is the theme here, just right off the bat.
Yeah, I can only imagine 1982, a bunch of, like, families walking out already, like, at this point. It's like, because, yeah, the poster, it looks like it's it's just two dogs running, and there's like a helicopter chasing them. It just looks like a classic, like,
it looks like North by Northwest, but with dogs what the poster looks like,
which it is not. Yeah, this one of the things that really strikes me about it is like its intense thematic pacing and tone that just is. It just starts at the beginning and goes till the end. It really does not waver for me. I think it's very consistent with its dread and intensity.
It's very compact.
And yeah, we learn early on in the lab, another disturbing thing we can see visually is that there's something wrong with, is it Snitter?
Snitter.
Snitter.
Yeah.
Played by John Hurt.
John Hurt.
Does a fucking amazing job.
Yeah, wonderful job.
As Snitter. Snitter. But he has a lobotomy of some sort. He has like a metal thing on his head, or just like, oh, he's been like experimented on, and he's like twitchy and similar to Watership Down, which I find interesting. Like, he is a character who is seen as sort of like has one paw in the realm of mysticism because he has these quote unquote visions, which we as audience members are left to ponder as like whether or not they are like actual mystical visions or just because like he's been experimented on and like is, you know, having psychosis or something, which is really intense. But he's like very earnest and very determined. Whereas like Ralph, they have an interesting dynamic that I love through this movie. Ralph is more pessimistic. Ralph is like almost the whole movie is just Ralph like sort of indulging him. Ralph was yeah. kind of ready to just stay and die in the lab.
Ralph was ready to die like, many times in this movie if Snitter was not there.
And early on, while they're still in this lab before they get out, we get this pretty eerie flashback to Snitter's past because he did used to have a master, unlike Ralph, and was involved in this horrible accident where he ran out into the road and his master tried to follow him and gets hit and killed by a car. So if all of this wasn't despairing enough, he has these memories of once being happy with this master and then blaming himself for causing his death. And then him eventually ending up being sold to this lab for experimentation. And this is all the first like 15 minutes of the movie. And, you know, the way that the animation looks, too, is very moody. There's all these shadows and canted angles as they're going through the lab.
Gorgeous backgrounds.
Yes. Yeah. Really, really beautiful, like, watercolor backgrounds, I believe, throughout this whole movie.
A lot of water. I would say a lot of it looks like it was done with colored pencils, too. I'm not positive about that, but it looks like colored pencils.
And yeah.
Something I noticed... close to the end of the movie, I noticed there's an interesting dynamic between the characters and the backgrounds themselves. Something looked a little off, and it wasn't until near the end of the movie did I realize the characters aren't outlined in black the way most animation characters on cells are. There's usually like that black outline to distinctify like the character from the background. And this one doesn't do that. There's no outline, and they blend into the background so well. There are so many shots throughout this film where if you just took like a picture of the shot, it would look like almost like a painting. It's very distinct style that really like the closest thing I've seen is Watership Down. Like the two styles are very similar. But this is something that you just could not reproduce in Flash. You couldn't reproduce this in CG. It is very unique to the hand-drawn format.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that is something that's just even a layman can probably see here is just how striking the visuals in the foreground can blend into the background, which the classic thing is always like Scooby-Doo, you know, like the... You know, Shaggy walking in front of the background, he's just so, like, not... He is very clearly, like, the moving object, and the rest is this, like, a totally different style. This seems so uniform. Even Watership Down seemed less sophisticated than the way the actual character design works on this. And maybe it's because there's only two characters rather than, like, dozens of characters. I think that also helps.
You mentioned his flashbacks, Snitter's flashbacks. Whenever he has one of those, and this is something that works for a movie adaptation of a book. When he has the flashbacks, there's this very unique visual style where it looks almost like a negative of a photograph. It's almost black and white.
Yeah, and one of the differences between this and Watership Down, I think, is Watership Down does have a number of these sequences that get very impressionistic and abstract, you know, from that opening, creation story and the different visions that Fiverr has. And I feel like there's less of that here. Like you did point out that there's the kind of negative, you know, looking colors in certain parts. And I know when they kind of make their little pact that they're going to become wild animals and live in the wild, that he has this kind of vision of like rocks turning into giant wolves.
Oh, yes. Amazing. That was wonderful.
Yeah. But it does seem like there's less of that overall in this. It's more, it is very moody and atmospheric and everything, but it doesn't quite use the possibilities as much for, you know, going really abstract with things, which is something I like in animation. And I think it's appropriate for this story, but that is something that stuck out to me because those were my favorite parts of the Watership Down film.
Yeah, right. I like that too. I mean, it was Ralph Bakshi who said he believes that every animated film should have more than one style of animation. And I personally have to agree with that. I like when they change it up. But the difference between Watership Down and Plague Dogs, again, or I guess another difference, is that Plague Dogs makes it very clear that this is not as fantasaical as Watership Down. We are clearly in reality. We're in a very stark, dreary reality compared to what we saw in Watership, where there's a bit more of a fantasaical aspect.
But I wouldn't downplay that moment, though, of wild psychedelia that happens when they do finally escape. It works so well.
There's still enough up in the air.
And in a way that only animation can do. Because that moment is really exciting because it is like so dreary the first part of the movie. And then when they get out, it is this very, it's an exciting other thread that's going on with the movie that is kind of, it's an abstract kind of theme going on that is the animals being free again and becoming animals again is sort of this thing that they're now like wandering the highlands on their own. And they come across this like Stonehenge sort of place. It's really weird. And is that where they kill for the first time?
They kill the sheep.
Yeah, they kill a sheep. So so these animals that have been like, they had masters and they were, you know, domesticated. Now that they are going back to a more, you know, natural, savage, however you want to look to it, kind of response to life. And it's kind of this mystical crossing of the threshold that is pretty badass to watch. And also kind of tragic, again, as they are like, they're going back to becoming these like predators. You know, it's good and bad. It's confusing. Yeah.
And those few fantastical moments do stand out more in this context because it's so much more grounded. And I really feel like that is in general what's missing from like badly in modern animation, at least the kind that you would go out and see in the mainstream, is they so much just want to go for this crisp realism where you just want to make sure that you can see every hair on their head and every blade of grass. And there's so little actual style in it. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we lost with two-dimensional and hand-drawn animation basically going away for the most part. And it's, you know, even something like Into the Spider-Verse that people were kind of losing their shit over, I was expecting something a little more stylized than we ended up actually getting. They were still these kind of like rubbery looking CGI guys running around. And it's just so refreshing to see something with the craft and, you know, distinctiveness that goes into this movie.
No, nothing can compare. It's abstract and like you said, Snitter's visions are so ambiguous that maybe it's real, maybe it isn't, but so much of the movie looks realistic in the way that only a 2D movie can. It isn't like you can do in CGI where you can see like every blade of grass or you can see every poof of dust. And I mean, if you watch behind the scenes features of a modern animated film, you'll see how much focus that goes into. Like, I remember watching a documentary on the day in the life of John Lasseter, and he always has his little his iPad with him, and he's looking over every frame of the movie Cars, and he's like, oh, there's not enough dust on the wheel there. We gotta add some more there. We gotta add some more dirt right there. It's like, kids aren't going to see that. Like, the kids that this movie is for don't care. It's impressive, don't get me wrong, but looking at older films like this, that wasn't the focus. It was always how can we take a drawing and make a drawing move? And You can't. There are shortcuts that have to be made. That's why when you study the look of a cartoon character and see how they make the move, it's all shortcuts. Look at something from Hanna-Barbera. Like, study the face of like Yogi or Huckleberry Hound or something. It makes no sense. It's all abstract, and it's these abstractions that are moving that fool our eye. And it's like a magic trick, and we don't really have the same type of magic trick anymore. It's how realistic can we possibly get? How much can we push this hardware? And this particular movie does its own thing. It's a very unique look in of itself.
And it's so much more evocative when it's requiring, you know, your mind to engage in it. It creates this, it's a lot like reading in a way where, you know, you're just looking at words on a page, but you do it long enough and it starts to actively involve your mind in it. And you start to connect with things more on an instinctual like level of emotion than you would, where, you know, when something is just photorealistic, it doesn't leave you any room to do anything like that. And that's like the magic of animation to me. Like, that's the whole point of it, is that it's not real, but it creates its own reality that your mind adjusts to. And I do want to talk about just how the animals do look in this, because, you know, they're not made to have human features or anything. But they're always like grooming and, you know, panting and scratching and licking each other. Like, all their movements are like pitch perfect. And I think they got that in Watership Down too. It's like, if you have a cat even, you know, or a dog, like, you know, you recognize how they'll be talking and scratching in the middle of something. And I was really like the movements of the characters.
It's so subtle though, because they also have the character of the Todd, which is maybe the most cartoony character you could say in this movie. Who's the fox, sort of a mischievous fox character who's already in the world of, like, the wild and killing and whatnot.
I found it ironic that they named him the Todd when Todd is the name of the fox from Fox and the Hound.
Ha. That's cute. Yeah, maybe someone that knows a little bit, but they got... Yeah, he's like the most cartoony character, but it's very slight. It's not like some kind of anime, like... Pokemon animal or something. There is some style to this character, and just like the dogs have some style, but there's always just a very, yeah, it's just riding the line in a way that works really well of them still maintaining their very clear like animal nature. They feel like animals still.
There's that dynamic between the three of them. We have our, like, the two main characters. Snitter had a life and Rolf did not. And then when they're forced to become in the wild, they meet this fox who kind of becomes their guide to live in the wild. I kind of would compare this, if you haven't seen the movie, I would compare it to something like in the Toy Story movies. There's the toys who have a view of what an owner is, who have been played with. The toys who have not been played with have a very different outlook on life. And that's very much the relationship between Snitter and the more pessimistic Rolf. He doesn't quite understand all the hubbub about having a master. And then there's also that untrustworthiness at first of when they meet the Todd, of this whole other life that neither one have experienced of living in the wild.
Yeah, it made me think of the, you know, in Toy Story 2, that just gut-wrenching, you know, interlude where Jessie remembers her owner outgrowing her and eventually, you know, leaving her.
Oh my God, and that's unwatchable.
It's a bigger...
Oh my God, don't even talk about it. The song is going to be in my head. I'm going to sob.
So, Sarah McLachlan song or whatever. And, you know,
when
and it's a bigger sequence. Exactly. Oh, yeah, it's horrible. And the book has a much bigger, like, flashback to, you know, Snitter having this idyllic life with his master who loved him. And it was just so heartbreaking. You only get a tiny glimpse of that here, really. It focuses more on the accident. But I definitely was getting that idea about, you know, the way that dogs, you know, any kind of domesticated animal depends on a human like that. And it's a real relationship, even if they're both perceiving it, you know, in fun, you know, different ways. So, you know, everything we've described so far is definitely there's an overwhelming just melancholy to this whole movie. The whole thing is just so sad and wistful. But there is some brutal stuff in there, too, because like we said, it doesn't pull any punches with how it shows the animals being experimented on. And even when they're out killing sheep, you know, we get some pretty gory shots of these sheep carcasses being eaten by crows and flies. And then there's this scene where, you know, Snitter, who's always looking for a man that he can trust, goes up to a guy who calls him over and looks like he's going to be kind to him.
Oof.
And he sets down his shotgun and Snitter jumps up, catches the trigger and blows the guy's head off by accident. And now he's blaming himself for killing two possible kindly masters. This is brutal stuff.
Oh, yeah.
If there was a reason I had any hesitancy to see this movie when I first heard about it, like years and years ago, it was this scene. Like there were like images on like the early internet in the 2000s of the guy holding his face with all the blood and everything. I was like, oh my God, what is this movie? Do I have the guts to watch this?
It's a scene like no other, because it is. Yeah. We also have the layer of what's disturbing about it is also the fact that he blames himself and he feels bad about it. He has like, and yeah, as again, it's like, I've killed another human. Like, what's wrong with me? I think there's like a line or something. He's like tossing and turning with nightmares and stuff afterwards. And it's like, everything bad comes from my head. And it's like, it's, you know, he's scratching at his lobotomized head and like, which is just a horrible, depressive thing that sometimes you can probably think when you're actually really depressed, you know, just like everything, it's all my fault. It all comes from me. And it's like, oh my God, there's no scene like that in movies. It's wild.
And this decision, this one accidental death that he causes, shapes the future of the characters. Because earlier we see humans out and about. At one point, we see some humans at a gas station. There's a little domesticated dog that comes out of the car while they're talking and just kind of barks around and yips. And that's kind of a...
It pisses all over their shoes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a view of like what could happen if they were adopted by masters. But by killing this one man, it creates a series of events where more people are against the dogs and more people are out looking for them. And that window into having a domesticated life immediately closes. They have a second chance at another life in the wilderness, but eventually something else happens to the Todd, and that door closes as well. And each really major killing in this movie has an effect. It isn't there just a shock.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's another scene where there's another guy who's aiming at Ralph out on the rocks and is about to kill him. And in the movie, the Todd ends up startling him, basically, and he falls to his death. And actually, in the book, it's Snitter who does that. So, and that's his, like, third accidental victim.
Which, it's a... Isn't it a deleted... Is it a deleted scene? I can never tell if I've seen an extended version or not. But I know in the theatrical release, it's cut out.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two versions of the movie. There's a theatrical and extended.
And the guy falls over and there's this implication that they go down and they eat him. Like both dogs like go down and they like devour him. And there's even like, I think you can find it on YouTube. I forget where I saw it, but there's a deleted scene like that. And they even like show a bit of his like corpse.
Yeah, I wasn't sure which version I watched because I did know there was an extended one. And in the one I watched, he falls. And when we go back to his body later, you can tell it's kind of torn open.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if they cut out something in between there or if I was seeing the cutout.
I think you were seeing that's the cutout thing, I think. Yeah.
Okay, because it's very clear in the book that they're starving to death and they have to eat this man. And that just pushes along the press hysteria, you know, afterwards, even though they didn't kill him on purpose, but they would have died if they didn't.
And I really adore, it's something that I haven't really seen in a lot of movies, like done quite like this, the way we hear from the humans. We rarely ever cut to an actual scene of two scientists being like, did you leave the gate open? There are, you know, where are those two dogs? They've been gone. Where are they? And there's just voiceover chatter. Like we're getting like radio signals and just like various conversations on top of each other as the movie advances. And we're just watching the dogs running across the highlands as this is happening, as things are snowballing. And throughout the movie, we have just more and more voices that we are just hearing in the air, just like, discussing like, oh, someone was killed, like it was a dog, like whatever, like there's these dogs. And then there's like further and further discussions about like, oh shit, this is bad, like back at the science, like the scientists are trying to cover up everything because there may be a possibility of bubonic plague that was injected in the two dogs, that maybe have just been spreading plague as they've been running across and having this wild adventure throughout this whole movie, which is another layer of awfulness and intensity.
And that's another example of book to film that I think has done so well. We have our main characters, and then out of nowhere there's this voiceover from these humans that we've never met before, we don't know who they are. Eventually it keeps happening, and then there become more scenes of humans talking to one another, but we never see their faces. It's just people looking at a map or sitting in a car or discussing the news, watching the news. What was once like a game of a phone tag among locals becomes a more prominent threat, and it begins to get wider coverage once we understand they're carrying the bubonic plague. And now you don't know, do we want them to succeed? Do we want them to find safety? Because if they do, they're going to start endangering these humans if they are carrying this
thing. It's another example of how this could not be any more of a departure from Disney, right? Where Disney, you have to explain like, okay, there's bad humans that are after them, so we have to create some villain that just represents everything that's coming after them. And he, like, there would be some scientist army character who, you know, we'd have to develop this stupid villain who has, you know, big stupid eyes or something.
He would also have to be queer coded and have a big luscious number.
Find me the plague dogs.
Yeah, I definitely want to dive into this particular aspect, because I don't want to belabor, you know, differences between the book and the movie, you know, neither of which probably a lot of people who are listening to this have either read or seen.
I'm curious.
But the book, which, by the way, like I just finished before watching this movie and I absolutely loved it. And I might go try to read Watership Down now because it was just so compelling. But it's a very different beast, I guess, you know, if you will. It's much more ambitious, I think, than Watership Down, from what I understand. And that, I mean, fully half of it is about these really significant human characters. So this, you know, it has this adventure going on with the dogs, which is brutal, but also has some humor to it. But it's also very much a satire about the media and how they concoct stories around them, about the government trying to cover their asses and deal with it themselves, and especially about, you know, scientists who are kind of overreaching in their pursuit of knowledge without necessarily the wisdom about how to use it and the responsibility towards these, you know, vulnerable creatures. And, you know, a lot of that's just a typical difference between a novel and a movie, you know, that the book has all of these, you know, characters with these really significant arcs. You know, from the journalist character, who in the movie version is Lynn Driver, we briefly see her face on TV and makes her one of the only people we get like a glimpse of in this. But it's a male named Digby Driver who's in the book, and he has a very big character with this whole arc and ends up actually trying to help the dogs as the search goes on. And there's this whole other layer. Basically, the movie is the equivalent of taking one thread out of the book and just adapting that. But I do think it's a really canny choice the way that they handle this. And they kind of make up for that by still giving us all of this important exposition that we just hear in voiceover. It gives us at least some faint echoes of those different themes that are explored in the book and not so much in the movie, because the movie basically makes those points just by staying with the plight of the animals. So for the, I think it's good because it's just a really smart adaptation choice to deliberately kind of exclude the humans, but still keep them as kind of this Greek chorus commenting on things. And also it doesn't, you know, get into any explicit kind of discussion or, you know, lecturing about humans' responsibility to animals. It kind of lets the situation speak for itself. But on the, I don't know, on kind of the flip side of that, I think it does take some of the layers away from the story, where basically we do have a single arc of these animals that are being experimented on and they escape and they're continually, you know, victimized and chased around and unable to find a place in the world until they reach a, you know, rather inevitable, tragic end. And I think that's maybe where the adaptation aspect of this kind of comes into play a little bit, where the way that it keeps giving us this voiceover, and there's lots of fade in and fades outs like over and over. So it's very episodic with these little snippets. And I think it's during those parts that kind of the seams start to show a little bit of, like, I can tell that it's adapting something a little bigger and more epic and trying to kind of get it all in there, which I thought was a much bigger problem with the Watership Down movie than with this one. I think this does work better as an adaptation, because Watership Down, I did get a sense almost like I was kind of getting the cliff notes of the book. Like, it seems like these characters could be a lot richer and there's a lot of action and we're kind of missing a lot. And that's something without having read the book that I'm observing. So it just feels like an adaptation, even though I wasn't really comparing it to anything. With this, I'm a little more biased because, you know, I was just coming out of this full 12-course meal, you know, of a book. And this kind of just focuses in on the most, you know, sorrowful part of it.
I think that was a good decision on their part then. I mean, the movie's only about an hour and a half. So why not just focus on a specific aspect of it? Because it's not, no book to movie adaptation is ever going to be perfect. I think this was, that's probably what the director saw when he read the book. He saw impact from the more morose parts of the book, and that's what he chose to focus on. I think that works.
Yeah, and I think that is, for the most part, something I approve of as far as adaptations, or even in biopics. I feel like it's like always just better to just like find a specific thread and emphasize that. If you really don't have, you know, the gumption and the ability to really bring all the threads together, which, yeah, quite often is just not going to work in a 90-minute movie. But, yeah, I'm very curious about the book. I would love to read it someday.
I definitely recommend it, and there's so much more to it, and it ends in a wildly different place than this movie does too. So you really can watch this movie and then I think still go enjoy the book and feel the suspense, because it is very, this doesn't really spoil anything, I would say.
Well, are we to the ending? Because it is one of the most effective.
That's quite an ending.
And if you think it's going to wrap up in a nice little way, it does not. Not in any way. It does not. They ultimately are chased all the way to the water. And there's men with guns after them, firing at them as they hop into the water and they're swimming. And the whole thing is it gets mistier and mistier. The implication could be that they're already dead. The little terrier is leading the way, of course, like he's been leading the way the entire movie. And he says, "Rolf, there's an island. I can see an island." And he's got Rolf chooses to follow him. They keep swimming for this island that we don't see as audience members, and we can only hope is there. And the movie ends.
And Snitter was the one who doubted himself with his visions. And this time, I think he changes his mind and he says, there is no island, and Rolf accepts it. No, it's there. We're going to find it. The implication being it's probably not there. They're probably just going to die if they're not already. But the movie chooses to make it ambiguous when, after we see the final shot of the movie, when we go to the credits, we cut to the image of an island in the background. That could be something that they saw in their heads, or maybe it was there.
Maybe they did make it.
And then with the uplifting song at the end, that makes it even more ambiguous. We don't know exactly what happened. I think it's leaning more towards they didn't make it, but there's a possibility of hope.
Yeah, I love that you brought up Rolf's actually, yeah, that he has an arc in this movie in that way, that he started out wanting to die in the lab and not wanting to go off of any, like, even if there's a shred of possibility of escape at this point, it's not enough for him to indulge these ideas. And after a while, like, once he's actually paddling in the water, he realizes, yeah, like, it probably isn't there, but it's worth it now. I get it. It's worth it for me to try, and worth it for me to try and push towards this thing that, yeah, okay, yeah, might not be there, but my other choice is death. And yeah, what a crazy way of ending a movie. One, yet again, like, of course, like, all the blood and intense themes in this movie are no-nos as far as talking animal movies for kids. But the other thing is, in those movies, is like, ambiguity cannot exist. There cannot be like,
no,
and especially an ambiguous ending.
Yeah, there has to be black and white, morally good, morally bad, no in between. And what I love about this is, if you watch the movie to the end, you've probably gotten over the fact of you know, animals killing each other in brutal ways and animals dying, and you've probably accepted the fact if you made it to the end of the movie. What I enjoyed about this ending was they kind of chose this. They knew they could die, but they chose to die with dignity. And they knew this was their option, but so be it. This is what they chose. And I think there's something beautiful about that. It's all about this concept of free will. They could have gone back to the lab at any time and died. They could have tried to survive in the wilderness and be shot, but they said, if we're going to go out, we're going to do it our way. And even though they probably do die, it's still such a satisfying ending in that respect.
Yeah, and it's the way that basically that exact point happens in the book, and it seems like that's where it is going to end. And apparently that's where Richard Adams originally intended it to end, and the original manuscript ended in a similar way. And at some point, I guess he was talked into expanding more on that from his publisher. And it's so the book at that point kind of ruptures, and there's this little colloquy like between the reader and the author. And, you know, basically the reader asking, how can you let this happen to Snitter and Rolf after everything they've been through? And I'm not going to spoil anything that happens on from there. If I did describe it, I think you would probably think that it was an absolute atrocity, the way that it like contrives things. But I do think it works on the page, and there's a real like big emotional force behind it. In this context of this movie, it would have been a terrible choice. Like if you can imagine that they you know go out there and then they somehow live like probably happily ever after in some way, that wouldn't really gel with this grim ass bleak movie that we've gotten. So it is nice to see this as kind of an alternate look at what the book might have been too. But I think the book builds the foundation and has enough of different tones and everything to it that it can make it work, where this is very laser focused on the sorrow.
For sure. I noticed that it's the same year as The Wall came out, which is, yes, another like step in the direction of like dreary, intense animation on screen for like a mainstream audience, or at least attempts at such things. Maybe the only thing this year that came out that year that I can compare. again, like another example of this 80s attempt or 70s attempt at like legitimacy for adult animated regular features is like the Lord of the Rings adaptation by Bakshi too, which has a, you know, a not, you know, a more of a PG-13 kind of leaning with the style and intensity. I think it is just interesting to look at these and see like what might have been if audiences would have embraced these things more. And they just were not embraced. There's an interview that I found online, I think that accompanies the Blu-ray of Plague Dogs, with the director. And he talks about just like how instantaneous the backlash was with the movie, and the theater is just like, it's just not going anywhere. And like women coming up to him after the fact, and it's like, who's the director? I want to talk to the director and things like that. It's just,
they had
very
Karens
much
back in 82.
I think they did.
This got a Karen's Cinema mom. Score F back in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, this is the point usually where we answer the question if we would unwatch a movie, either because we don't like it or because it is just such a bummer. And I mean, I won't answer for you guys, although it seems like everyone is pretty enthusiastic about this movie, right?
Yeah, I really adore this movie, actually. It was a big eye-opener for me as far as animation was concerned and what animation could do as far as being a legitimate vehicle for a real serious feature, you know.
I absolutely love this movie. It is a legitimate adult film. It just happens to feature talking animals, and it just happens to be a cartoon. If you can get over that and you can just accept it for a serious story of two fugitives on the run finding themselves and figuring out their place in life, then you can enjoy this movie. It is a beautiful hidden gem.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad that I watched that and Watership Down. And I do think that this was an improvement on Watership Down as far as in terms of as an adaptation and in the storytelling and the emotional power of it. If I'm a little less enthusiastic about it, it might just be because I was wanting a little more of an arc besides the torment being piled on. However, that is, you know, the power this movie has is basically the way that it commits to that melancholy all the way to the bitter end. And it very much does that. And it makes a very stark and powerful impression. And if above all else, I am very glad that it got me to read this book that I absolutely love, too, that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. So I say read it, watch it, and come back tomorrow. Now, that brings us to our next film.
No more dogs, now cats.
Now we're switching over to cats. And there's other similarities between these that I was surprised by as far as an aspect of medical experimentation on animals.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a link there as well. But Felidé, besides switching from dogs to cats, is a very different beast. I swear I'll stop these puns at some point. It's just so easy. And this is, if anything, an even more adult story, at least in terms of graphic content, if not sensibility. And this was something I'd never heard of before either. And I'm sure it's probably a little more obscure, but you can find it on YouTube just as easily as, you know, the Plague Dogs.
I would add, too, though, if you go to YouTube to find this movie, currently, as of this recording, there's one video that has everything except like the last couple minutes, and then there's a bunch of other videos that are just little pieces of the movie, so you might have to watch more than one video to see the whole thing.
There's also two different versions, one with an English dub and one that's in the original German language with subtitles, which is what I watched, and I would recommend. I guess I didn't see the English dub, but I've heard that it's not great with the translations because it wasn't like this was never officially wide released in America with an English version. I think it was more of a basic dub.
This wasn't going anywhere. Yeah.
No. There's no English English home video release of this movie.
Yeah, and generally I try to watch even animated films in their original language just because, you know, the performances are modulated exactly the way that it was intended to. Though it would be nice to be able to soak in, you know, the visuals a little bit more without worrying about the subtitles, at least when it comes to animation. But still, I was happy that I watched it that way.
I couldn't find that. I had to watch it with the dub, and the dub sucks.
That's what I heard.
I think the dub's real annoying.
I thought it was okay.
I don't know.
It's very rushed.
Yeah, some of it's good. Some of it is very clearly, like, poorly translated. There's, like, all kinds of, like, maybe, like, sped-up sentences or, like, okay, I guess that word is appropriate, but not really. And I find, what's his name, the main character's voice to be kind of grating for some reason.
Francis,
yes.
He sounds like Wishbone.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. Like dirty Wishbone.
I also watched the dub because I couldn't find the German version.
I sent you the link, you motherfucker.
Well, then I also couldn't find your link.
Oh my God, you suck.
Well, that's good. I was afraid everyone watched the original German version but me. So as someone who has seen a lot of dubs from not just Japan, but many different countries, they did a pretty good job of keeping the lip syncing the best that they could, even though they didn't get many A-listers or anything like that.
Yeah, so this Philly Day, oh, and there's a cat.
Perfect.
Speaking of cats.
Meow, showed up meow. Just in time.
Probably should have said up front. You know, I think that generally out on Watchables were big animal people. Like when I grew up, my dad always had anywhere from 3 to 7 different little dogs, and currently I've got 2 rabbits who are a little over 10 years old now. I got 3 cats, and it was 4 for a little until the one that Tony just held up, they adopted because they just keep showing up on our porch and we're running out of space. But definitely a big cat person, and I had that in mind. I watched this movie with my cats. They didn't seem to mind it.
Yeah, they're just like, what? Rated R movie.
Yeah.
Cat decapitations, hey.
Yeah, it did make some stuff, you know, get under my skin a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, both these movies are definitely going to get, that's what the unwatchable aspect is. Even if they are animated, they are going to, if not disturb you and like make the animal and lover in you cry. This movie perhaps is more on the side of like, it just makes me feel awkward or something, because there's all these weird like animal sex scenes and animals farting and shitting and peeing and dying and I don't know.
Yeah, this is basically a seedy murder mystery that's full of graphic bloodletting and violence, but it's acted out by cats. And is this actually based on a novel, a 1989 crime novel by, I'll just take a stab at this name, Akif Perinci. He's a Turkish-born German author, and there's actually an 8-book series of Feli Day novels, although only 3 of them were ever translated into English, including the one that this movie was based on. And even the book is kind of hard to find now because this author, I guess, got into some right-wing extremist kind of parties, made lots of incendiary comments about Islamic immigration, and specifically some sort of tasteless Holocaust joke or statement he made in a speech that immediately caused him to be dropped by all his publishers, boycotted. I don't even think you can buy the book on Amazon anymore because they just delisted everything. But he did co-write the script for the film, which again isn't the most accessible thing, but you can find it on YouTube. But at the time, in 1994, apparently this was the most expensive animated German film ever.
And you can see it in the animation. It looks pretty slick.
It looks great.
Especially for a foreign flick imported to the U.S. Looks pretty nice.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I do think, to our conversation about Plague Dogs and style is what it lacks for sure. I find a lot of the character designs and even the backgrounds are probably the highlight, and even them are just sort of like, I don't know, they're fine. But the character design is just, I find very lacking and kind of boring, like just very basic, like these are animated cats with cartoony faces, kind of not so much blurring the line between anthropomorph and actual like animal very well. Just feels like cartoon cats that are naughty and solving crimes.
Like overall, it has a nice 90s animation renaissance look to it. It looks a bit like something that Disney or Don Bluth would have put out. We'll explore this later on, but there are some more abstract elements in the movie, but not as unique as the Plague Dogs. A lot more mainstream look of the times, but still pretty nice.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit more on the positive side about it. I definitely see what Seth's saying about the character design, and this is definitely more typical. But I guess I thought that there was still a lot of very like moody lighting and atmosphere throughout that I still generally liked how it looked. And maybe it's because, I don't know, the version that I watched was in really good quality too, which sounds like there's a lot of not very good looking ones out there on YouTube. And since I was the only one who watched the German language version, I think that I probably watched the best looking like transfer of it, I'm guessing.
With the dub, if you're watching the dub, because we've never gotten a proper English release, every version you've seen is a bootleg. So if you did watch, I would imagine it looked a lot better than what we saw.
Yeah, although it is interesting that the director, it's Michael Schack, I think, doesn't have a very extensive filmography. I mean, there were some German animated films in there I'd never heard of. The thing that I did recognize was an English language Pippi Longstockings film, which is what? Like a kind of thing I never watched, but I can picture the like VHS cover of it.
A very naughty Pippi Longstocking.
Yeah.
A very German Pippi Longstocking.
So I don't know. This doesn't have as much of a pedigree behind it, I think. Although I still think this probably looks better than the Pippi Longstocking film. I don't know. I do feel like you can kind of see the money on the screen with a lot of the different sequences.
Especially the dream sequences. Yes. Similar to Plague Dogs, it has these like intense dream sequences, which, yeah, like, how can you not utilize that when it comes to animation? Because it's just like, oh yeah, I can do whatever I want. It's an animated movie. Anything that I can draw can occur. And yeah, there's some crazy nightmare scenes in this movie. They're probably the major highlight and definitely some of the most quote-unquote unwatchable aspects of the movie.
Yeah, I feel like the dream sequences would be something that like someone puts on YouTube and says, really effed up children's movie or something like that, and it would get like 2 million views.
They could put it with that nightmare sequence from The Brave Little Toaster.
Yeah.
Which one?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it depends. There's
the whole movie?
The air conditioner, and then later on there's... Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. That's pretty grim. But that is an actual children's film, and this is very, very not. I don't... Like, if this did come out, I think this would get an R rating.
Yeah.
This was in... The America.
Yeah, where Plague Dogs is more of this PG-13, it's more in that rated R thing. I think it's still, though, in a weird spot where it's just trying to be, again, and we keep on bringing up Bakshi. We will do an episode on Bakshi and Fritz the Cat, but, like, you know, Fritz the Cat, for instance, is just, like, there to, for the sake of, like, can you believe we can have tits in cartoons now? Can you believe we can have blood in cartoons? And that's, like, the whole shtick of the movie, just, like, for 90 minutes. This movie is more hung up on this idea of, I think, just sort of, yeah, I don't know, just not thinking about animation ideas, right, that, like, tropes that we're supposed to associate or, like, ideas of an audience for animation. It is sort of just, like, a regular crime thriller that just happens to star animated cats.
This movie is a film noir with cats.
Yeah, it really depends on that dissonance between the two forms of the crime thriller kind of noir, you know, thing being acted out by cats.
Every once in a while, I think I'm just watching a Saturday morning cartoon, and then I'm like suddenly reminded by watching two cats fuck. That this is not a Saturday morning cartoon.
It's a Saturday morning cartoon until you see like a cat's anus.
Lots of cat anuses.
Yeah, there's the rumored butthole cut of the musical Cats, which I, you know, may or may not actually be true, where they had to digitally remove the buttholes. but they didn't. The buttholes are an integral part of the design of this film.
Boy, they are. Well, yeah. Should we get to the what this weird little movie actually is about?
Yeah, I'll be really brief for that, because it's a standard kind of murder mystery, basically. Where our main character Francis moves with his owner into a new house, and there's strange things going on in the basement and in the attic, and there's cats that are turning up dead all over the neighborhood and brutally murdered with their throats torn out, sometimes disemboweled or beheaded. And he basically, meets some of his cat friends and starts uncovering this big mystery. It involves a cult. It involves a lab of animal experimentation that was shut down. And it's just him unraveling the mystery from that point on.
Like a noir movie, there are a lot of different noir figures. We have the femme fatale, potential love interest, and then the red herring. You have the info dump character that is there to serve as exposition. You have his Watson sidekick that helps him along. It is a murder mystery with cats, but kind of like our last movie, it's also cats behaving like cats. They do not get up and walk around like Puss in Boots and put on human clothing. They are just normal cats.
With buttholes.
Yeah, this cat sex scene that we keep referencing too, which is our main character who gets seduced by this cat, is a very realistic cat, seduction and mating, if you've ever been lucky enough to witness that.
God, it's so gross.
it's real cat sex.
The best part of this scene to me is there's this pan at the end of the scene. There's this pan to the trees, and the animators, like, they decided this is a good place to stop. So the animation cell just kind of freezes. It's one cell of the cats for a few seconds as we're panning up to the trees for a fade out. And it's Francis looking into his lady friend cat's butthole. And we see that on screen just as it is for a few seconds, a little too long.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. To me, they pan up to the tree branches to get away from the oral cat sex going on. And to me, it really looked like two crows were up in the trees and they were fucking. I don't know if that's real, but it looked like the
two crows were watching.
I thought they were fucking and watching. I don't know, but I don't put anything past this evil movie.
Crows are notorious voyeurs.
That was too much for me. This probably spawned a lot of furries,
I have no doubt it spawned a lot of furries.
It's got to be in the pantheon. It's like there's just a lot of talk of, there's like the cast are just constantly talking about sex. They're constantly like wanting sex, and like there's a lot of like innuendos and things. There's a lot of weird like, and I was looking for this a little bit once I found out the guy was kind of a shithead and like possibly racist or a Nazi. There's like weird sort of homophobic remarks every once in a while that I picked up in certain scenes where they're like talking about like, oh, you've been frequenting, you're one of the gay cats or something like that. They're just like insulting each other, these like men cats, just like talking about how like you're probably a gay cat, huh? Like weird, like you're going to the homo cat bars, like weird stuff like that, which is just like already uncomfortable. And I'm just like coming out of the mouths of these Saturday morning cartoon cats.
The one cat might even be gay or bi. I don't know. But he calls Francis pretty many times.
Yeah, the big bear cat.
Yeah.
That's one cat. I did not like his design. He was very ugly to look at.
Oh, the one-eyed cat.
He's so generic looking, yeah.
And there's these other cats who are like giant and don't resemble cats at all. And I kind of wondered what was going on with them.
Yeah.
Are they dogs? What are they?
Yeah, the designs are really weird to look at. Just like, what even? Is that an ear? Is that a beard? What is that? Like, and yeah, that big guy is really weird. His like girlfriend, like, well, that's the whole thing. Like, how does it work? They keep on finding murdered cats, and they're pretty grisly murder scenes that they happen upon of these cats. and they're all, they realize, in various states of sexual arousal.
Yeah, they're all chasing females in heat. And that does factor into the, you know, discoveries made about the mystery and what, you know, what's going on here. But you're right. The one of the most unwatchable parts of this is that, you know, these are very graphic. You know, you see their throats torn out. You see their intestines coming out of their bellies. You see that, the, you know, the blind cat has her head torn off and doesn't pull any punches with that. But I thought the most disturbing part was when Francis comes across this video of medical experiments that this professor Praetorius does, where he's testing this tissue adhesive and he keeps trying to use it and it just burns right through the flesh of the cat. It like melts their skulls and you see them struggling and in pain and, you know, being tied down.
Oh yeah. You get a close up of them making incisions and of all kinds of shit.
That was the roughest part for me.
That was like the opening minutes to Plague Dogs, basically.
Right.
It's true. Yeah. I didn't realize just how thematically linked these were in a way. Although, I mean, we can get into it later. I think this one has a lot less to do with like the actual animals or the idea of animal dignity or like humans being good to animals and things like that. This seems very much more just like, again, it just happens to have cats in it. It seems to maybe want to say something about, because there is like an anti, like, humanity is like being cruel to animals and whatnot. And the cats talk about it a lot. And there's obviously the lab scene, which is really disturbing, but it doesn't really like push into it any more than any movie that's trying to be edgy is doing, which is like, it's very easy to just say like, man is the worst. Like that's basically the extent of it with this movie.
I would say this movie has everything to do with cats because they keep tying back to the title of the movie, the Felidae, but they explain was their ancestor that was the version of the cats that was back in ancient Egypt that was worshipped by the Egyptians, and they come from this bloodline, and the cats that we see on screen are this imperfect version that have devolved over time. So we have this movie all about the origin of cats. And then also just normal things that cats do, like after they have sex, they smell. There's that aroma around them that becomes very integral to the mystery. I feel like there's just a lot of moments in this movie of just cats being cats, and it's such a specific thing that if you're a cat owner, you'll be watching the movie, you'll be like, oh, my cat's done that.
Yeah, I do think it does a good job of making this kind of a feline specific plot that unfolds. And there is, you know, the explanation does have this kind of like they bring up Mendel and there's kind of a eugenics kind of thing going on, right? That's where they're trying to purify, right?
Which is interesting in the context of this guy possibly being a Nazi or like Nazi sympathizer or Holocaust denier, which makes this like even stranger in hindsight.
Yeah. And when they get to the end and he says something like, this cat has lost his innocence and so has man. I wasn't really buying into, you know, this having like that particular kind of thematic resonance, you know, even though it is dealing with stuff like purifying the race or getting back to our, you know, genetic thing, it's really just the resolution to the mystery. I don't think it gets particularly deep with that, but it does throw it out there. And it is, I mean, kind of interesting to see that applied to like, you know, wild cats and the way that they breed and reproduce out in the wild.
The feline equivalent to the Aryan race, if you will.
Which is like a lot of that is surrounded by one of the other more disturbing scenes, which is this cult that is sort of sprouting up around these ideas of cat eugenics, which we are introduced to kind of early on in this crazy scene where the cats are, there's like a big cat and he's preaching all this crazy shit about sort of this like cat martyr that they worship. And the cats are jumping into this like bunch of electricity and shocking themselves as like part of this like crazy ritual, and it's so intense and weird, and I've never seen that. Yet another thing where you're just like, what is this movie doing? What is happening?
They all worship this cat who supposedly died in these experiments by a Dr. Pretorius, because I believe his name is going, it was definitely a reference to Dr. Pretorius from Bride of Frankenstein. I feel like that was definitely on purpose.
Right.
Oh, you're right. I knew I recognized that name.
The gay scientist from Dr. Strange?
Yes. Yes. The actor who played him in real life was gay. Yeah.
Yeah. The guy with the little jars with tiny people in them.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
But eventually the cats stumble on the video of him doing the scientific experiments, and he is also in the dream sequence. Francis has more than one grisly dream about the murder, and I think when we think of the dream sequences, both are pretty messed up, but we're probably thinking of the first one, where it's a giant priest rises from the ground with a bunch of cats on strings, like marionettes, but they're all dead bodies.
Oh,
and crazy. Seth, you brought up the wall earlier. I immediately, when I saw that, I thought of Scarfe, who is the animator on the wall, and also the character designer on Disney's Hercules, Scarfe. And it looks very much like his animation. They slowed the frame rate down, and it's very sketchy looking. And if you see this and you put this next to animation of the wall side by side, like you would see the similarities. It just amps up the nightmarish factor of the dream sequences even more. It's a lot less polished than the sequences that we see that are in reality.
And those surreal dream sequences were definitely my favorite part of the movie, because they, you know, they are kind of scary and they're really out there. And it just kind of ties back to, you know, me saying that in Watership Down, I really liked when they got impressionistic and, you know, used all of those possibilities of animation. And so that was definitely what got me most excited here, was when they were exploiting that. There's another one, I think, before that, where this faceless doctor is putting like a chain leash around Francis, and the house is morphing around him.
That was gorgeous.
Yeah, they're very cool looking. They're very eerie. And those were definitely the high points of the film for me.
I would say the humans, too, are also animated differently. And the plague dogs, we never really, except for that woman on TV, we never really see the faces of the humans. But in this one, we see the humans a lot more clearly. They have a bit of a sketchy style to them, kind of a 70s Disney or Don Bluth kind of style, where you can still kind of see the pencil lines in the animation compared to the cats, where you don't. It's very smooth and very flat.
The can openers, that's what the cats call them.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's right, the can openers.
Humans are just can openers.
That's all we are to them.
I think cat owners could probably relate. Sometimes you're just a can opener. I do want to say, though, that this cat, that Francis's owner is a terrible cat owner. I mean, he's got his unneutered male cat just running around town having sex, getting involved in murders, fighting with other cats. He doesn't seem to ever know what's going on. So shame on Gustav.
There's also a lot more, and I don't know if this was edited down for the dubbed version, but there's a lot of these moments of just silly, like, black space, just fade to blacks every once in a while. Like, it feels like there's like a commercial break, which is just such a like annoying thing in a feature film.
It was like a direct-to-video movie where you've got like several episodes kind of like thrown together. It is a very episodic story, but there was like no flow.
That's weird too, because I mean, I definitely noticed in Plague Dogs that there was a lot of fading to black and back in. I mean, I think easily as much as in this.
Well, yeah, Plague Dogs just feels so much more like filmic and cinematic. To me, it feels so much more like a worthy theatrical feature where, I don't know, something about Fela Day just really strikes me as like a glorified, like made for TV movie or something.
Yeah. And I think that just even besides visually, this is still, a pretty insubstantial, you know, substance wise movie that it really is just about unraveling the mystery. And I am kind of curious how involving you guys found that as far as, you know, putting together the clues and everything. Cause there was a certain point, I mean, not that far in, where I felt like I got ahead of everything, where the guy who ends up being the bad guy, I was thinking, this is the bad guy. This is not who he says he is.
Yes, the old cat with the computer, which I like, it's a great staple of a 90s movie. Anyone who has a computer and he's building like a database of various cats in the neighborhood. Just amazing. And the other, Francis's mind is blown. He's just like, we have a list on a computer screen of names. Amazing.
I think what gave it away really was through animation. It wasn't really through any dialogue or anything that gave this character away as being the big bad. But there was one quick shot where he gives like a bit of an evil glance. He does like a bit of an evil grin. And I was like, he's the bad guy. Every other character is like a red herring. It's this one guy with a computer at the beginning.
It seems like a type that you would see in a movie like this. Like the guy who is always helping the main character. And it's always a twist that he ends up being the one who's behind everything. And he has nefarious plans for the main character. So that all seemed kind of boilerplate as far as what to expect. And when we do see that video of the medical experiments, I feel like it lays out what must be going on pretty clearly as far as, you know, that's where we learn about this race of, or how the doctor wants to breed this Claudandos cat. At least that was the name in the German version.
Claudandos.
And yeah. And that this, so you know that it has something to do with it wanting to further the bloodline of this cat and that this cat must still be alive. I feel like it just laid a lot out.
The doctor's really drunk the whole time when he's doing all the experiments. He's just like constantly drinking. And then they like do a montage of him doing all these horrible things to cats. And then one of the lab assistants like walks out and he's like, oh, you son of a bitch. You don't know how brilliant this all is.
So where did you guys end up ultimately with this movie then? You know, would you watch it either for it not being worth all the gross stuff or not enjoying it? Or were you just kind of, you know, middling is kind of the sense that I'm getting, but maybe not.
I think you might be surprised. The way we've been talking about this movie, I think it sounds like we've been pretty harsh on it. But when I watched it, I didn't expect it to be nearly as good as it was. I know it sounds like we're being pretty middle of the road with it, but I absolutely thoroughly enjoyed this movie. I would not unwatch it. It has some flaws, definitely. And when it comes to, I mean, obviously I haven't read the book. I would like to now after seeing it, but obviously I haven't read the book. But this does kind of what you shouldn't do with adaptations, and that's try to cram everything in. They really try to put a lot of stuff in the movie, and that can make it confusing. And yeah, I knew who the bad guy was, but it was so unique in its aspect of cats being cats and just this ancestral plot line, this weird sexual aspect to it that really did play into the story. And just seeing, I think just seeing a big budgeted animated film from Germany that could look like an animated film from America, it could easily masquerade as one if you're watching the dub and you didn't know that this was a foreign flick. Not to the levels of like a Disney movie at the time, but definitely at least direct to video And I was just impressed. It was something that hadn't been on my radar. And anytime I see like a movie for adults from that time period that is not Ralph Bakshi, that is not an anime or something else, like a Nelvana film, just seeing that from like the 70s through 90s, that era where we would get an occasional adult animated movie, finding another one is always it is always such a joy to be like, how did this slip past me? How did I not see this? And I found myself interested in the mystery and the horrifically dark aspects of it. So yeah, I really enjoyed this movie, and I watched this movie in chunks, but every time I watched a little bit of it, I could not wait to see what happened. So I think that alone, I would say no. I would definitely not unwatch this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting things in it. The dream sequences, obviously the sort of like, what the fuck, like disturbing, strange aspects of it that are just so like still very novel in a movie like this that is just, it feels like it's from another timeline where this was allowed, which just really was not. And it is interesting to see a movie from this time period that does go to such extreme places. I think I was surprised by the end. I was kind of intrigued in the net of the plot line, which I think is really just something to attribute to the author of the book, that which I'm sure we're only getting like a percentage of like what all was going on with like the film noir network of, you know, who's doing what to who and stuff like that. I did find that interesting by the end because I was kind of in the middle. I think I wind up pretty lukewarm about it. Just as a sit down, watch it kind of experience, I'm a little lukewarm about it just because I think it's just maybe a animation preference too, that it just didn't really strike me all that much. And you know, and maybe it's just, I'm comparing it to Plague Dogs as well because we're doing it for this podcast, but I do think it kind of like, I don't know, for me, it maybe loses its chance to really utilize the animal aspect of the story. But there is, you brought up good points that it is like utilizing like biological and like basic facts of like the way cats work, which I think is like, again, very unique. It's very unique. I can at least say that. I wouldn't unwatch it because it is a weird part of animation history for sure.
And just piggybacking on what you said, I do wonder how that would be with rewatching this movie. I don't know if my reaction would be the same. Something like Plague Dogs, I think, would undoubtedly hold up as just as emotional as it was the first time. I'm not positive how I would feel about seeing this movie another two or three times.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the nature of the kind of thing that it is. It's, you know, like going back and watching or reading The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or something, where it could be kind of silly fun at the, you know, unraveling it at the time, but there's not much there to continually go back to. And you can only really find out, you know, by going back to it. I think I probably land maybe a little closer to Aaron than Seth enthusiasm-wise. I was reasonably involved in the mystery, and I think that the juxtaposition of using cats in this context did go reasonably far as, you know, keeping me involved in things. Like, I didn't love it, but I didn't really come away disappointed or anything from it. And, yeah, it's not like a poorly written movie or anything. It's just kind of slight in the end. So, you know, time will tell, I guess. But I was pleasantly surprised by how easy I found it was to watch, to keep going and want to see what was going to happen next, even when I was starting to suspect where it was going.
Ooh, I feel cool. I liked it less than Mark.
Wow.
I'm no longer the podcast film slut.
Well, Aaron, I definitely want to thank you for coming on. This was, you contributed a whole lot to this discussion, and this was really fun.
Thank you for having me.
No, you know your stuff even more than I thought you did. Yeah, impressive.
But yeah, is there anything that you want to, you know, promote or give a shout out to while you have the ear of the nation?
Yes. Yes, I guess I do. You can follow me on Instagram, and I'm now on Twitter as Dizstorian. That's D-I-S, Storian, like historian. And that Instagram is mostly where I just show off my collectibles, aka my junk that I collect. A lot of Disneyana comic books and crap like that. If you want to see me travel the country a lot, I go to a lot of cons, I go to a lot of weird off the beat places. That is on my normal Instagram. That's DizWiz1982, DizWiz1982. And while you're there, check out the link to my buddy's Instagram. His name is Colin. He goes by a Kiwi and Kiwi Clothing. The two of us had made several indie comics together. We call them Kiwi Comics. I do the writing, he does the drawing. And check out the link to his store on Etsy, because even if you're not interested in comic books, I promise you this guy does everything. He does sculptures, puppets, any kind of art you're interested in. I got to give a shout out to my good friend Colin while I have the time.
Yeah, and we'll tag those on our Instagram too, so anyone following us on there can find Aaron, and we'll link to those in the episode description.
I feel like everybody was probably very excited when you said cats, but then they found out it was not a podcast about cats. It's about Felidae. But we should do cats someday, for sure. I promise. I promise, my fellow Americans.
That is definitely unwatchable.
The day the butthole cut finally comes out, that's when you gotta do the podcast.
Yes. Release the butthole cut. Let's get that going on Twitter. Let's see if we can pull off a Snyder cut-esque grassroots campaign.
He needs adventure. Adventure means trouble.
Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti, hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening.
Cat killer on the loose. Deep Purple is dead. Found him in the gutter, bloody in the head. Cat killer on the loose.